when you take blockchain and like, what is it really at the core of what we're doing, right? Or what is this industry at its core? And it's really the first way in history to transfer value natively in a digital world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Colors of Web3 and Entrepreneurship. My name is Lum, your Web3 host, your host today. And for those of you who are new to the show, Colors of Web3 and Entrepreneurship is a show highlighting the journeys of builders and innovators in the Web3 and entrepreneurship space. Some topics, especially in Web3, may get technical, but we do our best to keep it accessible for most people. In this episode today, I am joined by Ali Madhavji. He's the managing partner at Blockchain Founders Fund. Ali, can you give a quick introduction about yourself?
Thanks so much, Lam, for having me on the show. So Ali Madhavji here, managing partner at Blockchain Founders Fund. We're a venture capital firm that invests in and help venture build top-tier startups in the Web3 space. We've got over 130 portfolio companies now in the space. So backing a lot of really, really incredible founders, you know, building the future for the world and for the Web3 space.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for the introduction. By the way, is your fund mainly focused on Web3 or do you invest in other sectors as well?
Correct. So we are a Web3 focused fund. Having said that, we do invest in intersections of technologies, right? So take AI and blockchain in that intersection. We started investing in, for example, in 2019, you could take AI and a number of other industries, right? Of course, like AI at blockchain and gaming then, or you could go blockchain and pet industry, or you could go blockchain and the music industry. And so there's a lot of different intersections of this technology and how it's transforming the world.
Yeah, it's true. Completely agree. I think Web3 usually, some people have told me that it's more like another layer that get me put on top of other industry, right? Yeah. And some people also
absolutely
told me Web3 is a standalone industry. So whichever way you look at it, yeah, absolutely sure. Okay, that makes sense. Actually, I would like to get to know a bit more about your professional background. So feel free to share with us your professional background, like what you did before you established this fund. How what basically maybe share from the timeline from when you began and then leading up to this current day of when you run this fund.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Canadian by background, and you know, I always started off with a very entrepreneurial spirit. So for context, my parents are actually refugees from East Africa. And when they moved to Canada, you know, of course, there was a ton of hardship, right? They basically moved with the clothes on their backs. And that, I think, at a very early age, set me up to really challenge the status quo and really, you know, go out there and try to figure things out on my own. And so by the age of 18, I probably had already 10 small businesses that I'd been running across all sorts of different things from computer networking to building and selling computers to helping people get content, you know, well before there was Netflix. And that's a whole another discussion, but all sorts of really, really cool things. And, you know, it was just really ways to get by, right? You know, following that, did my undergrad at the University of Toronto and started off my career at PwC, first in Toronto and then in New York in the assurance practice, got my accounting and finance designations there, and then moved into corporate turnaround. So helping companies that are about to go bankrupt return to profitability. And for anyone that's not familiar with corporate turnarounds, essentially, you know, your boss comes to you and says, hey, this company, you know, with 3,000 employees has 4 months of cash, go fix it, right? And then you basically have to go for the next 4 months and figure out how do you fix this? How do you solve this cash burn? How do you get this company laser focused on its core, you know, where there's value and basically cut out anything else where it's really going to take the company under? And, you know, this costs a lot of people their livelihoods, right? If you have a company of 3,000 people that goes under, a lot of people lose their livelihoods. And so the objective here is, you know, how do you save, you know, this company? And so did that, you know, extensively across the US, Canada, and even in South America. Lived in Brazil for a while doing that. You know, simultaneous that, had a number of different roles. Also used to write my free time, published a number of books. So published 3 books in the education space. 2 of them made it to number 1 on Amazon in that category. And also used to serve on the board of directors of the University of Toronto, served on a number of other alumni-related boards for the institution. And, you know, went down the rabbit hole on Bitcoin. And, you know, I think that transformed a lot of the way that a lot of the trajectory of my career sort of going sort of forward past that. Ended up moving full time into the crypto space while I was at INSEAD, and we started a crypto exchange at the time. Raised several rounds of capital, you know, ended up growing out a double digit member team. And, you know, that was sort of the original catalyst then for, you know, a full career, you know, now seven plus years later in the Web3 space. Following exiting that, we started Blockchain Founders Fund. So in 2017, we started Blockchain Founders Fund. We now have, as I mentioned, 130 companies in the space, so a lot of really, really incredible companies that we've backed over the years that are really shaping and transforming the way that, you know, the world works. So we've been really excited about being part of this journey with just a lot of really incredible and brilliant founders.
Awesome. I see. So tell me a bit more. When did you first hear or learn about Bitcoin? I think that transformed your trajectory, right? Yeah. Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, so it's a good question. So I came across it a number of times, and I think the big thing, and anyone who sort of came into Bitcoin fairly early, you know, I think we'll understand this. You know, if you sort of grew up in a context of, say, like only in the West, and you're surrounded by, say, you know, how society works in the West, whether that's in the US or Canada or the UK, or even a number of other countries where even, you know, take Japan or across, you know, more stable nations, I think it's oftentimes hard to fully grasp the power and the reason for some of this technology. Given that, you know, I grew up in an environment where, you know, my parents were refugees, you know, understood the instability of government, understood, you know, even the manipulations of currencies that you see around the world, and having sort of a keen understanding of that, I think it really helped me to resonate around why this actually is game changing for the world and why it's required. And that was sort of the initial catalyst to getting into Bitcoin. And, you know, in reality, that whole narrative or reasoning has only, you know, amplified. Right. And I think oftentimes when people think about Web3 or think about blockchain, they're really getting lost in a lot of the noise. There's a lot of noise in the space. Right. And I can give you some quick examples. When you take blockchain and like, what is it really at the core of what we're doing? Right. Or what is this industry at its core? And it's really the first way in history to transfer value natively in a digital world. Right. And if you think about where we were, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, we weren't spending any time in the digital world. And now society's spending 50, 60, 70%. If you go to kids these days, they're probably spending more than 70%, you know, in the digital world. Right. You know, I think this is critical for society to be able to track and have value natively in a digital layer. And then when you talk about NFTs, and a lot of people think NFTs are these, you know, monkey images, right? And that's sort of been what people have seen with like Bored Apes or, you know, take punks or like stuff like this. And it's really further from the truth. I think this is a real misconception around what NFTs are. NFTs, in reality, it's the first way in human history to transfer ownership in a digital world and track ownership in a digital world. And if you think about how society innately works, it's all about ownership, right? We track ownership of our house and our car, and pretty much everything is all about possessions and ownership. And when you think about, you know, the most like disorganized or like, you think about like, say, third world nations, things like this, usually these are countries where, you know, property rights aren't secure and you know, vehicle rights aren't secure, and all of these like basic necessities around ownership aren't there. And so really, if we think about how much time we're spending in the digital world now and how that trend and trajectory is going to continue going forward, it's actually a necessity. So it's in our opinion, it's a, you know, basic human necessity to basically track ownership in the digital world as it is in the physical world. And that's just how society works. And so these are critical technologies to how we form and move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that blockchain have helped. And yeah, I think that having the perspective of being both with the developing world and developer world, developed worlds, and probably help you understand much better of how the importance of blockchain. So I believe that in among many countries in the world today, is a developing nation to actually have more adoption of crypto. I think for one of the reasons is just to fight against inflation, fight against their own currency, right? We've seen that with Argentina, a few other nations.
Nigeria, there's many. Egypt, you're seeing it. Yeah. I mean, it's very true, right? And this is where even stable coins have a profound impact on people's lives, right? I mean, you've got, you know, different people living in countries where inflation is even north of 100%, where real inflation is north of 100%, maybe not reported inflation, right? But, you know, these people now have a way to actually at least stabilize, create a store of value, and then, you know, maybe even, you know, do a lot of other things that they'd want to do as a family, or seek education or healthcare, like all these different, you know, requirements that people have that.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think it's all thanks to the blockchain and crypto, right, for that to happen. Before we deep dive a bit into your current founder's fund, actually, I'd like to can you share with us what do you do for fun in your free time outside of work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do love to hike. So I'm originally from Vancouver, and you know, in Vancouver we live right on the foot of a mountain. So love to hike, love scenic views when you can find them. I also play floor hockey, you know, fairly often as well. Love ultimate frisbee, if there's any ultimate frisbee fan, beach volleyball. So these are definitely things that I love to do. Also a big fan of chess.
What's floor hockey mean, by the way?
So floor hockey is similar to, say, ice hockey, except you're playing in like more like a gymnasium type of floor, but same type of equipment.
Okay. Do you play on regular rink? You need a rink, right? Or no?
Yeah, so floor hockey, essentially, you can play in like a gymnasium type of space. You could literally even play outdoors, just like on cement.
Oh, really?
Or
okay.
On
so
sort of, yeah.
So you don't have the roller skate? You don't do the roller skate thing?
So I do love roller skating, but no, when we play hockey, it's not roller hockey. It's floor hockey.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the image of the ice hockey whenever I see, right? People rolling around. I think they call it roller skate, right?
Oh, ice
whatever
skates,
it's
ice
called. Skate. Sorry, I'm not so. ice skating, yeah. So ice skating and then hitting the ball. So you don't actually ice skate, you just roll on, you run on your shoes or something?
Correct, right?
For
yeah. So there's essentially a few different types. So there's ice skating where you have ice skates, there's roller hockey where you have like roller blades.
Yeah.
And then there's just floor where you run. So we play more of that. But a big fan of all three.
Cool. Sounds like fun. Yeah.
What about you? Cool. Tell me what sorts of stuff do you do in your free time?
Free time, yeah. So well, lately I've been super occupied, but free time, I would say lately I do calisthenics. Calisthenics is like a new sport that I picked up, I would say, 2 or 3 years ago. And I do surfing, but mainly in the warmer seasons. Technically, can go in the winter too, but maybe I'm too lazy or chicken to go in the winter. So calisthenics and surfing, those are my fun stuff. I like to attend a lot of festivals. Since my main base is in Japan, right, I like going to a lot of the festival here in Japan. Is actually have many festivals around the world, and also like to try out new foods, new restaurants, new cuisines. Japan, actually, one trivia for many people who do not know, it's not Paris is not France, but actually Tokyo has the most number of Michelin star restaurants in the world.
Wow, I did not know that. So I learned something new. Fantastic.
Yeah. So next time, if you have the chance to go to Japan, you can try even, of course, you can try the fancy Michelin, which costs a couple hundred dollars per visit, or you can try one that costs like maybe $10 or less per visit, which is really cheap. It's like a one-star Michelin ramen. Really cheap in Japan.
The best way to do it is you try both, right? And you get the experience on both sides.
Yeah, it's amazing. I gotta tell you, man, regardless whether it's one star or three star, they're both amazing. Yeah, it's like, I think once you try the one-star Michelin ramen, you don't want to go back to the regular ramen anymore. It's not the same. It's not the same, you know, but you can't go to the Michelin ramen every day because, I mean, either it's not costly, but it's just too time consuming.
Because you long have lines, to
either queue I'm in sure. line or, yeah, long line, like the whole reservation system, things like that. So, yeah, it's not so convenient. But anyway, so, yeah, those are some of my hobbies that I do. Anyway, yeah, without further ado, let's go ahead and maybe talk about your current company, VC, a bit. Yeah, Moksin, feel free to share with us any screen that you may have about your company and talk a bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can talk a little bit about Blockchain Founders Fund. So we started off in 2017 and started investing in and working with really incredible founders. And, you know, the sort of inception of Blockchain Founders Fund really didn't start off as a fund, right? So after we had exited our last business, you know, the main objective was, well, you know, instead of, you know, founding or starting or working on one company, let's do it on two companies. And instead of in two companies, it became four companies. Instead of four companies, it became eight companies in terms of being able to support incredible founders and, you know, help work with them on some of the biggest challenges or bottlenecks to really unlock growth. And so that was sort of a trigger behind the inception of Blockchain Founders Fund. And now you can see, you know, off of our Crunchbase as an example, we now have over 130 investments. We've been an extremely active fund in the Web3 space. You know, just on a quick look here, you can get an idea of all the incredible companies we've been backing this year alone. So only in the past 2 months, you know, we back companies like Scallop and Validation Cloud, many others like Squared Labs, Zero Line, Beeble. By the way,
Scallop, I just want to say that Scallop, the founder of Scallop, CEO, was actually on my podcast. It's the third episode. I'll leave a link up here for people who want to check it out. But yeah, it's the third episode about Scallop with Chris Lai. Very fun. Yeah. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of really, really incredible companies that we've been backing, you know, really impacting all sorts of different parts of the ecosystem, right? So Validation Cloud, as an example, is really infrastructure in a lot of ways for layer ones and major chains. You know, you go from that to companies like Omega really transforming, you know, real world assets. And, you know, this has been a really big theme, you know, to companies like Emoja at the bottom there, you know, which is working on, for example, liquidation protection. So if there's any traders on here who have, you know, traded crypto and maybe you've been liquidated from you know, an options trade or something like this, Emoji is really coming in and solving that problem with creating liquidation protection, which is one of the biggest problems on you know, crypto or Web3 trading. So that's, you know, a lot of really, really cool companies that we've been backing and continue to back a lot of really, really incredible founders in the space.
Cool. Can you tell us how many people work at your fund right now?
Full-time employees? Yes, so we've got a team of about 10, and you know, that includes everything from supporting our companies, our investment team. You know, we even have you know, legal counsel on our team that actually supports our companies around like risk and contracts and making sure that, you know, they can move faster. One of the things that, you know, we really pride ourselves on is helping founders solve some of the biggest challenges they have. And from talking to a lot of our founders, you know, we saw that so many of our companies were just spending so much money and time on legal at an early stage and oftentimes getting run in circles by lawyers. So we were like, well, let's just solve this, right? Let's bring on an expert onto here where we can provide a ton of different resources, you know, help them with, you know, templates and then even like reviewing legal contracts for them, things like this to help just speed up and make our companies, like, you know, help them move faster. We did the same thing even around designers, as an example. We pay for designers for our companies and they can tap into our designers as a way to, you know, help them flex up or scale up in terms of, you know, their needs on these things. You know, we've got 150 corporate partners. So we're tier one partners with everyone from Amazon to Google to Twilio, HubSpot, all sorts of other really, really incredible companies. And we've got an expert network of over 300 experts that support our companies. And these are, you know, everything from Fortune 500 senior executives to fund managers to successful entrepreneurs, some of them with multi-billion dollar exits. So we really try to build an ecosystem of support. You know, so when we come into an investment, there's a lot of support we can bring companies to help them scale and go to the next level.
Cool. Yeah, totally makes sense. Do you have technical people in your team, by the way? Sounds like 10 people, but you know, sounds like you have a variety of different functions there.
Yeah, so the way that we break down is each of our partners and team members have a sub-thesis that they focus on. So we go very in-depth on very specific sub-thesis. Right now, we've got about 25 open sub-thesis where we think there's major problems in the Web3 space and no market leader. And we get extremely familiar with this space. We understand, you know, who are all the different players in it? You know, what stages are they at? Do we really think that this, you know, is a major problem in crypto? You know, what is sort of the pathways where we think it actually makes sense to scale, or, you know, what approaches do we think sort of make sense to win this market? And then we basically, as we get very familiar with that, then we go out and find any other companies we weren't familiar with that, you know, if we think there's a real opportunity here for a new player, and we go out and find, you know, very interesting players across these very specific sub-thesis. And then, you know, we basically dive into those. And then if it's, you know, on the hyper-technical side, we do bring in experts to help us to vet that side, right? So that helps us a lot, depending on obviously the stage of the company.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Because I know some of the areas in Web3 can be very convoluted for outsiders to understand. And you mentioned 25 sub-thesis. So usually when I hear VC, usually they have like one main, big main, like overarching investment thesis, right? Do you guys have fun like that, or?
Yeah, so we do see a lot of fun sort of approach it that way. And our challenge with that has been this industry moves so fast. If you take the themes from 5 years ago and what the sub thesis or like those thesis would have been from funds, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago in this space, they really wouldn't be that relevant today, right? A lot of them wouldn't. Like the industry has sort of moved so fast that you know, these wouldn't be necessarily as relevant. So we actually believe in going very hyper granular into specific problems, right? So instead of saying, hey, we're interested in DeFi as a whole, we want to know exactly where and what specific sub thesis can actually win, right? So if you take then like, how do we bring yields on chain? Because that is one of the biggest problems on DeFi as an example. And then like what opportunities are there for like decentralized yields on chain? How can we go about that? Can we find players doing that? And then how can we execute that, right? So we like being a lot deeper rather than having these sort of broad market thesis. And that allows us to actually find very targeted companies, right? Because on these broad thesis, like you won't have a company at a startup stage that's tackling the entire thesis anyways. So we believe in sort of going much more.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that angle from there. Can you maybe share with us some of the sub-thesis, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I mentioned just now real-world assets. So, you know, one of the biggest problems that we've seen in the DeFi world, as an example, is there's no yields on chain, right? Or no effective yields on chain. And when you do get yields on chain, you're generally taking a very large underlying risk on the asset. So if you take right now, say you had $1,000, right? You know, you could basically put it into US treasuries or treasury somewhere and you could earn 5-6%, right? And if you went into DeFi, what's happening is it's very difficult oftentimes to earn 5 or 6%. I mean, there are certain things like Mountain Protocol where you can go earn now, but these are some of the newer things coming out. But then if you take in the traditional world, you can go do, you know, pretty low risk lending, for example, lend to residential real estate on very high quality loans that are over collateralized. And, you know, you could probably earn something like 12 to 15% even, right? In the DeFi world, you can't do these things, right? And so we think that there's a very interesting opportunity to start bringing very effective yields on chain. And I think it democratizes the industry. If you take some of the other narratives that we've been quite interested in, you know, you could look at dev tooling as an example. We think that there's still major problems for developers to actually scale and build solutions effectively. You're seeing a lot of repetitiveness being built, like a lot of very similar things that are sort of needed for all companies being built by each individual company. And so, you know, we recently backed a company called Uniblock that's basically built a unified API for Web3 for developers. So instead of each developer going and building 50 separate APIs, they can just integrate one API and then click one button to turn any of these different, you know, features, company, you know, features across all these different companies just on and off, right? So it's going to save, you know, probably 1 to 2 FTEs and, you know, an entire year of just build time for some of these things. So, you know, it's a lot of really cool things like this. I mean, we've been very interested even in things, you know, on BRC20 or on the Bitcoin blockchain. So, for example, you know, lending derivatives on Bitcoin have been fairly interesting. I mentioned liquidation protection earlier. So, you know, how do you solve sort of that issue of liquidations on in crypto? A really interesting one that we've done a couple of investments in recently was Intense. And this is one that maybe is not talked about so much, but Intents are essentially, you know, in a trading world, if X happens or if X and Y happen, I want to do Z, right? Or Z. So it's based on like a couple of different factors happening. I want to do something else. And we think this is actually quite interesting. And we're seeing a huge opportunity for Intents to even consume the OTC markets. And if you think about how OTC markets work, they're fairly opaque and they're massive markets. And so we see huge opportunities for Intents to start consuming parts of OTC markets and really bring that on chain. So that's been something we've been pretty interested in, made a number of investments in that space as well. So yeah, always, you know, pretty dynamic. These sub-theses do change, but those are some of the sort of more recent narratives where we've been looking at.
Interesting. Yeah. Actually, I'd like to know more about the liquidation protection. Is that mainly for the users or for big companies? Or
correct. No, so it would be for users, for big companies. I mean, we do see in the Web3 space, there's just a lot of, you know, traders. If you think about what is the biggest use case for crypto, I mean, it's still trading, right? I mean, there's a lot of other really interesting use cases coming out and sort of pushing the envelope. But trading is, you know, a very big use case for this space. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of people that, you know, get hurt from these liquidations. Even if they are correct on the direction things are going, the volatility can cause, you know, pretty significant liquidations. And that's where this liquidation protection starts to actually, you know, be pretty game changing for traders.
Okay. So does it work? Are you integrating this with centralized exchange or decentralized exchange?
You can look at it on both. I mean, typically where we see, you know, tremendous value is, you know, one, obviously you have a lot of these liquidations on centralized exchanges. But two, we're starting to see more and more volumes move towards decentralization, right? Obviously, with the implosion of things like FTX and even other centralized finance platforms like BlockFi, Celsius, et cetera, you know, people don't want to make the same mistakes, right? And so a lot of people are actually moving more towards decentralized platforms. You're getting incredibly better decentralized platforms into the market nowadays. Even with things like order books, similar to centralized exchanges, things like this. So we're seeing actually value on both sides here for this. And if you do want to check it out and learn more, you can check it out on Emoja Labs, or Emoja is the company. You can check out what they're doing, and it's quite fascinating.
So I was doing the math earlier. You have said you have 25 sub-theses with 10 people. So I guess each person is probably, okay, well, assuming you have a few employees, and not all of them are handling theses, so each person probably carry 4 or 5 theses at the same time.
I mean that sounds about right. I mean, as well, like some of these theses are more or less relevant initially, right? We build them up over time, and then we also see different bottlenecks to, you know, where and what's required to scale certain theses, right? So I'll give you an example. Even if you take like the gaming sector, right? So blockchain gaming, obviously it's been a pretty popular topic back in 2021. But we still see major problems around blockchain gaming, right? I mean, from an experience standpoint, you still have user experience challenges from blockchains, right? So things like gas fees impact user experiences, things like that. But not just that. I think the biggest inherent problem in blockchain gaming is most of these, or nearly all of these so far, have been designed where they basically have a set of NFT or assets, whether it's swords, shields, whatever, assets in their game. And as this game gets more popular, so say there's 100 swords in the game as an example. As this game gets more popular and 100 people join, maybe all of these swords are $1. But then when the next 1,000 people join, they also want those swords. And so now these swords get bid up to $10. And then the next 10,000 people join, and now these swords are $100. And that actually creates a really big problem because it starts creating its own barrier to entry to new players. Like the next 10,000 players won't want to join because like you're kind of too late, right? And you can't get these assets. And then, you know, you have a major disadvantage. And so this has actually been a very big challenge, I think, for blockchain gaming in general. And so we actually see a very interesting opportunity around fully smart contract-based revenue share mechanisms. So imagine where without having to go do this daily, but there's essentially auto management where you can basically put those assets onto a smart contract where anyone can basically go borrow either that individual asset or even an entire collection of all of your assets or a portion of your assets. And you can just say, I want 30% of the revenue you earn from this, and you can go use these assets, right? And that's a really cool way to solve the problem where now new players don't have to put any money to come into the game, but they can basically give up part of their future earnings, right? So they can say, hey, I'll give up 30%, I'll give up 40%, but I want to borrow this collection, right? And this is all, I think, quite game-changing for solving that problem in the gaming sector.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard some of the potential solution about that. Actually, I'll probably leave a link up here for episode 10, where I actually had two guests who were in the crypto gaming, where they discussed, I think, basically a similar problem. And they're some of the hypothetical solution to it as well, too. But yeah, I think it's fascinating. One thing I've noticed recently, because I think the new bull market is coming back. And then with it, there's a bunch of new protocols and new games also. I've actually tried out some new Web3 games lately. One thing I've noticed is that the quality as in the quality of the game, how it's played, right? Because in the past, what we've seen in like maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years ago is the game's quality in terms of graphics, play mechanism and everything, which is really bad. It looks very, looks like a game from the 1990s, you know, like the ZNES and those very basic thing. But now I've seen some really high definition game being made now with integrating certain parts of it onto only the critical components. Sorry, maybe not critical component, only the parts that's needed is linked to the blockchain. Maybe let's say you acquire an NFT that contains your experience saying that you have done this and done that. So that one, that part is on the blockchain. But the other remaining part, maybe let's say you're an RPG, you're an adventurer, you're fighting like a sword fighter or something, and you go, you kill the zombie, you kill the bad boss, and then the quality graphics have increased significantly. So I'm actually quite surprised. I think maybe we can expect some really interesting high quality games linked to Web3 this cycle, is what I'm saying.
So I think we're definitely quite excited about the higher quality, you know, AAA games, AA games coming to and building on blockchain. And I think it creates a really, you know, the Web3 angle actually creates a very interesting mechanism to help these games scale and grow. Now, having said that, the whole market, if you think about gaming, it's not just about AAA and AA gaming, right? Actually, what most people maybe oftentimes miss is the majority of revenue, close to 60% of revenue in gaming, comes from hyper-casual games. So these are actually very simple games. And that's where we also see a lot of opportunities, right? So they don't always need to be these AAA games. I mean, when you think about, or, you know, I spent some time, for example, with some of the biggest gaming executives in the industry, in the traditional gaming industry. And, you know, one of the interesting things they told me is they're looking for games in all different types of categories, right? Like they want those AAA games, but when you're on the bus or the subway or the metro, you're not playing that AAA game. You're playing something else. When you're on the loo or the toilet, you might be playing something else, right? And so there's all these different types of games that actually resonate even with a single gamer. And so we actually see a huge opportunity around hyper casual games as well. We actually invested in a company called Breshna, which is bringing together gaming, AI, and a no-code builder, essentially, where anyone can create their own hyper-casual game in under 10 minutes. And then they built the world's first text-to-game engine. So now you can just say or type what you want, and it'll build you this hyper-casual game in seconds. And it's actually really, really cool because what we're starting to see is even broadening of the gaming industry. So we're seeing teachers use it. We're seeing nonprofits use it. We're seeing games for, you know, whether it's education or social impact or even like female health and hygiene. We're seeing all sorts of different games. You saw a Paris Hilton game, all sorts of really, really cool stuff that's being built. And they've actually had now, I think, 170,000 games created, 2 million players playing these games. And so it's a really different way to think about gaming as well from what we traditionally think about gaming.
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah, so good news is I've also tried out some hyper-casual games. Web3 games that actually just released recently. You probably might have heard of like Mavia. Mavia would be one, right? There's a few others, actually. There's so many lately right now, and they're deploying on a variety of blockchain, mainly layer 2s, as I see it. Usually layer 2 because of the gas. But usually they don't... There's not many that on-chain transaction from what I see. They're mainly... Like I said, most of the stuff is still, in order to keep the high graphics, most of the thing is still off-chain until you get some sort of a achievement. Yeah. And then, but yeah, I'm excited to see what new things that will be bringing. With that said, any particular... So I think we both know that as of the date of this recording, I think we are officially in a bull run already. Probably most people don't realize it yet, but I think yesterday Bitcoin just hit the... just slightly broke the previous all-time high from a few years ago. So which make me quite curious now, what are the narratives that you think will be very big for this bull market cycle? Yeah,
we spoke about a few of them earlier because it blends obviously with where sub-thesis are, right? Because those are sort of around those narratives. But, you know, we talked about intents. We talked about real-world assets that we think is an interesting one. We do see some interesting things around DeFi trading and things that mask gas fees, relayers, sequencers, stuff like this that we think are quite interesting, especially on some of these different chains. We are quite interested right now and quite bullish on, for example, some new layer ones that are coming out. As an example, Barrachain, for example, is a EVM compatible blockchain built on proof of liquidity consensus. Definitely, if you haven't taken a look at Barrachain, we do think it's one of the next big chains. So it's definitely something interesting for people. We're even seeing a really big sort of movement around decentralized physical infrastructure, right? When we talk about how does this sort of go mass market, get to consumers, you could take Deepin as an example. And we saw obviously early successes, let's call it, and maybe ups and downs with Helium. But we see huge opportunities for Deepin across a lot of different companies and really bringing people together where they can earn off of providing data or providing something using certain technology that we think is quite interesting, right? So we are quite interesting around Deepin and what's happening there. Those are a number of the different sort of themes that we're seeing right now. But at the end of the day, like as with all of these bull markets, there's going to be, a lot of things on the consumer side, right, are going to obviously have to be hot, right? To have a full mass market, bull market, you typically have some very large consumer plays. In the last bull market, obviously gaming was a big part. You had, you obviously had centralized finance, so that ended up quite big, right? With Celsius, BlockFi, FTX, like, which, you know, you got to be careful with those because those aren't, you know, native blockchain, if you think about it, right? Of course, there's a lot more risk when you're dealing with centralized, you know, platforms. But yeah, we see a ton of opportunity right now. And I think it's really just getting started.
I see. Yeah. I think this is my personal opinion. Yeah. I'm sure you probably have already made up your mind on what your companies want to invest in already. But I think in a cycle, probably at most three probably really pushing it. Two narratives, like narratives that will be winning in a certain, you know, I'm talking like a bull market, right? Yeah, and in a cycle. I don't think we can have like five or six narratives winning at the same time. It's quite hard, in my opinion. I feel like it's getting, because there's only, this is my opinion, I think there's only so many people right now who know about Web3, right? Of course, we still have to bring a lot more people into Web3. But I don't think there's enough people yet to really to spread it out all over to five or six different narratives, right? So like you said last time, we had gaming. I think gaming was certainly NFT. I think was pretty huge craze last time. I feel like this time AI for sure is one of the huge narrative that will win. Deepin, I'm not so sure personally myself, because I feel like for things that may require hardware, I feel like Helium just require too much work for the people, right? To sign up. Too much work, right? This is like the barrier, right? The barrier is like too high for people to, you make people require them to do so much for so little reward. And sometimes it's like even negative rewards, right? So I feel like the tokenomics is like, it's not so much working. Lately, I've encountered some other Deepin company. It's not physical, but there's some completely online, maybe like sharing GPU, sharing your bandwidth. I think sharing your idle bandwidth sounds a little bit more. Yeah, sharing bandwidth. I feel like that's actually more, feasible and also sustainable, right? Feel like it. I mean, depend on how they work with the tokenomics. So, but it's probably easier for people to grasp and understand than Helium. One other, I don't know if we could call this like a narrative or not, but meme coin. I to be honest, I'm quite neutral toward meme coin, but I feel like there's meme coin is just really easy for people to rally towards, right? We know that from both of us, we both in Web3 for many years now, we both know that meme coins, they don't do anything, right? It's just memes. They don't really have any intrinsic value, and which is riding the hype. But I somehow I have a feeling that there might be some meme coin aspect for this narrative. So AI meme coin, I think layer one or maybe layer two as well. So probably it'll be the three that I'm kind of
And then thinking ZK is obviously one we skipped on here, but ZK I think will be quite hot.
ZK as well too. But I feel like, but I'm not sure about it for this cycle though, to be honest. I feel like, because like I said, there's only so much attention, right? So I feel like attention has already been given enough to AI, to meme coin, and then to layer one and layer two blockchain. Now we actually have so many more layer two blockchain now due to the Polygon CDK and many other frameworks now available to people to launch. So it's not as difficult as in maybe when you first got into blockchain, in 2017, right? I think, or when you first began your fund, I think back then it was very hard to build your own blockchain, but now it's actually quite much simpler. I wouldn't call it easy, but much simpler, right? There's framework to build it now. So, but like, who will become the number one or maybe the top? There's only so many blockchain that can survive the fight for the attention, right? You know, I mean, there's only, because if you think about it, for me, right, from a, let's say, for example, from a consumer perspective, how many wallets can you keep a user to be able to keep up with, right? Because for every, let's say you have a different blockchain, like a new wallet, like maybe MetaMask is on EVM, but then you have another blockchain and then another wallet. And then sooner or later, you have like 10 wallets, right? So how do you, there's only so much attention, right?
Tell
so
me about it.
This is what my thinking. Yeah, there's only so much attention. You cannot just like, even if you don't have a full-time job, but I mean, for both of us, we have a full-time job on the side. Obviously, there's only so many things you can do. So
It's true, right? That's also where we're really excited about tooling and like interoperability among chains. And there's a lot of really interesting protocols right now going up around, you know, ensuring interoperability, allowing you to do multiple, like fairly deep interactions with a chain, but doing it from other chains. So like, you know, building in numerous things from like atomic swaps to even like going directly into liquidity pools on other chains, or even like yield, like basically like yield generation or deploying assets on different chains and like managing that, automating that. I think there's a lot of really cool things happening right now that we're seeing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm actually quite excited for what is yet to come, even in this year and in this cycle. One thing I think you also said earlier about Bitcoin ecosystem, I'm also quite bullish on that, because it feels like we were not able to do anything on Bitcoin. I'm talking like fancy stuff, like maybe smart contract and programming. But I feel like this cycle, there'll be some new release of Bitcoin things. Things are happening on Bitcoin, right? Besides order nodes and inscription, those are also quite very exciting as well.
Yeah, there's those a can actually ton be of things happening on Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I'm just barely catching up with like order nodes and inscription. Those are like super fascinating things. I think the mass market will probably not understand it until few years later. I'm pretty sure there'll be a lag, right? There'll be the innovator, early adopter. So like, yeah, so much later for that.
Absolutely.
Going back to your company, I'm quite curious, and I think many people would also be quite curious to know, what is the day-to-day like for a VC? Do you have a typical schedule, or do you just you do what you like, or tell us more about it?
Yeah, so I mean, of course, I think it's one of those where a lot of people see it as a very glamorous profession, and you know, in some ways it is, right? But it's not easy, right? I'll give you some examples. I mean, typically, we look at, you know, close to 500 companies a month, you know, and then we'll fund, of course, a handful of those. And, you know, it involves, you know, speaking with a lot of really incredible founders. I mean, oftentimes you'll get onto companies with, you know, that haven't figured out product market fit or their go to market. And then you'll get onto companies that are obviously further ahead, and like they'll have different insights, different, you know, ways of approaching things. But what's really cool, I mean, if you think about it, we've probably looked at well over 10,000 startups just in this fund alone in the last couple of years, right, in our second fund. And so, you know, we see, you know, 100 companies working on the same thing over the course of 6 months, as an example. And we can really try to understand the nuances, differences, and figure out, you know, which one should we be backing or where should we be backing. And so that is actually quite an interesting aspect of being a venture capitalist. You know, and then a big part is like going out and supporting our companies. There's a ton of things that we do with our companies, help them, support them, grow. You know, we actually want our companies typically to be doing, you know, updates as an example. And so that they can, you know, share what their successes are, but share, you know, what are some of the challenges they're facing. And I think one of the really cool things when startups do that is we're able to more easily go help, or any of the other investors, any of the other advisors, easier to mobilize. But startups like, hey, I'm really having trouble, you know, getting banking in XYZ country. Four investors are going to put their hand up and say, hey, I can just introduce you to this person. And then they'll all make different intros. And, you know, instead of spending 10 hours, 20 hours trying to figure this out, 10 minutes later, you've already got four potential pathways to solve the problem, right? And these are the really cool things that, like, we help our, you know, our founders, our startups get more structured, more organized around. And then, you know, that allows them to sort of, you know, scale, solve some of these problems more quickly. So that's actually quite important. So we actually, the way we think about a lot of different things is we actually get very involved. So for example, when we talk about updates, you know, we probably went through 1,000 different investor and advisor updates from all these different startups, and then built our own template that we think is a lot more streamlined. And then we actually share that with our company, so they have a very easy, you know, process to follow. We did the same thing with things like data rooms, and we spent 3 weeks looking at data rooms from all sorts of companies, and we built our own structure and process so that, you know, when we actually go invest in a company, we want them to be at a strong level when we invest, but we want them to be even stronger, you know, out the door, right? And so, you know, after we invest, we'll help them to even like beef some of these things up so that they're putting their best foot forward and really coming at it from like a world-class approach. Same thing with Dex, right? Like we went and, you know, found the, you know, a ton of different companies with the best product slides, solution slides, traction slides. And then we share these things with our companies to get ideas, examples of, you know, how can they actually be better? How can they actually approach this more effectively? And that's actually worked really, really well. So these are some of the types of things that we then do to support our companies on a daily basis.
I see. Yeah. So there's like a lot of working with your portfolio companies. Do you mainly invest in, is it seed, pre-seed, series A? What in what stage of the company do you absolutely invest in?
So we write checks from 200K to 5 million on the high end. And, you know, typically our entry points are seed and pre-seed. We do some series A, even some series B from time to time, but, you know, very selectively. And in the crypto space, there's usually like very clear reasons why we're going to go do something that's, you know, a little bit later, but we see huge opportunities around it. And so a big part of this though is, you know, we like to get under the hood. We like to understand a company. We like to like help support them, really get to know them after even all of our due diligence. We want to get to know them, and then we go write larger and larger checks into it. So we, what's interesting about our fund that's maybe different from a lot of other funds that you see out there is we tend to write fairly large follow-ons in comparison to a lot of other funds. We get under the hood, we know the company, we track the company, we've already put in some money, and then we go, you know, upsize that, you know, pretty quickly as we see things grow.
I see. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. So many people have told me that I think for VC, it's like a numbers game. You have to spread out many different investment, like so many, but then you, well, statistically speaking, I mean, I love numbers here, so feel free to cite any numbers from your fund if you have, because I used to work as a data scientist, so numbers are things that come quite natural for me. People told me that for VC, usually, like if you invest in 100 companies, probably 90 or 95% of those companies will probably fail, right? They're very, very high likely. Especially like the early stage, but then only the one that win go on to become a superstar, and then the huge outsized, what is it? I think the word is asymmetric returns, right? Or asymmetric, returns on your investment, which make up for all the other one. So I don't know what your take is on that.
Yeah, so we've seen a little different to that, right? So what's been really interesting about the last bear market in crypto has been, you know, just a lot of really incredible founders that like became extra lean, kept the lights on and kept building incredible products and at an incredible pace. And now as the market's turned around, we're now, you know, in this bull market, you're actually seeing all of that payoffs. So you're seeing a lot of companies just like being able to raise, you're seeing a lot of attention on it, a lot of investors coming back to the table that like weren't deploying really in the bear market. And that's actually been really incredible. So, I mean, I think you quoted 90% of companies fail. I mean, we're not seeing anywhere close to that, like through that last bear market. It's, you know, probably in the range of like 10% that are failing through that bear market. So we've got a lot of really great companies that, you know, really tightened up, pulled through and like scale, like grew revenues, grew numbers, have incredible metrics that like really are making it very easy to raise. And right now already raising some pretty incredible rounds through this market. So we're really excited about the companies we've backed in the portfolio.
That's awesome to hear. Yeah. If only if 10% fails, and I think sounds like
we're not at the end of the journey, right? But yeah, exactly. I think it's really good leading indicator right now.
Okay. And also, you said you've been investing in this since like 2017. So I'm assuming that, and usually you invest for both, is it both tokens and equities or typically? Or?
Yeah. So we do invest in both. Having said that, we're quite particular on this, right? So we don't want to be investing. I'll sort of give you a very clear example. What we don't want to be investing in is there's an equity company, founder has equity, he's raised on equity or she's raised on equity, and then they launch a token and they do a SAFT only deal, right? Like for us, the challenge with that is value is going to accrue to the equity company and not necessarily the token. So if we're investing in one instrument, the token, but values accruing to the equity, like that's sort of a win-lose sort of narrative, right? And we don't like that. So we like win-win. So, you know, what we want to do is, for example, the company's got a SAFE plus token warrant as an example. So we actually get upside on both. And so if value accrues, if there is an equity company, if value accrues on both, that's okay. Or obviously we want value to move towards the token, but in the case where it doesn't, we're still protected. Now, we also like the scenario where it's a SAFT only and there's no equity company and there's no value accruing to an equity company and structured ideally as like a DAO or moving in some sort of way where there's, you know, governance that's quite clear. And so we also like that, right? But we don't like that scenario where the incentives are misaligned between the investor and the founders or the management of the company. And I think that gets pretty dangerous in crypto. We saw a lot of that go wrong in 2021, and we're quite cautious of that. And we really hope that other investors are aware of this problem, right? Because it burned a lot of people, I think, and a lot of funds, some of those funds, which are not even around anymore today because of those issues.
Yeah, you mentioned a very financial, technical related keyword. For those who may not be familiar with like the finance and VC world, can you explain what a SAFE is?
Oh, SAFE. Yeah, sorry, my mistake. So SAFE is basically an agreement for future equity. So if you're a startup, you know, your best way to raise, typically, depends on the jurisdiction, but your best way to raise early on is generally using SAFEs. And so SAFEs are essentially, you know, you can, the best way to do it is go to the YC website or search SAFE and YC and you'll find in Google, you'll find the YC templates. It's going to be the fastest way to raise because, you know, typically with fundraising rounds later on, you need to do a price round. You need to get all the investors to commit at the same time. You got to get them to all come in at the same time. It's a very lengthy process. It's legally intensive. It's cost intensive. So you don't want to be doing that as a startup, right? You basically want a document where investor can sign, send the money, right? Obviously, they're going to do due diligence before they sign, but you want to simplify the whole process. That's essentially what a SAFE does. And then, of course, in the token world, they've got the SAFT equivalent, right? Which is essentially for future tokens instead of equity.
Yep. Awesome. Yeah, very clear explanation. I hope that make it easier for the viewer to understand. Yeah. And I'm also a big fan of YC. They back a lot of like amazing companies so far. So actually, coming back to your company, so what are some of the challenges facing for a VC, for a founders funding? What challenges do your company face?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest, you know, we just want to continue to see more incredible deals, right? I mean, we look at about 500 deals a month right now. We coordinate with, you know, close to 300 VCs even per month. But we always want to see more and more deals. We want to see them earlier and earlier, right? I mean, our objective as a venture capital firm is to be aware of these companies and then to go back these companies really early, right? And the challenge I think that you have when bull markets come around, and we're seeing this already, right? We're seeing probably about 30% of the market have very expensive or very inflated valuations already for where they are if you were to compare it to, say, traditional venture capital. You've probably got about 30 to 40% that's, I'd say, like in range of being somewhat reasonable. And you've probably got 30% that's probably right now that's probably undervalued, right, in some ways. But obviously, there's a lot of struggles. There's a lot of investor attention that might be difficult because there's a lot of good deals right now. And so, you know, I think these are, that's definitely a challenge though, right? It's obviously we want to find companies early instead of, you know, coming in at very, very high valuations. And then we want to, the other part about coming in early that's very beneficial when we know about deals early enough is we can help them structure things to be more and more effective, right? To actually make and fix maybe issues on token economics or fix issues on growth and help unlock growth. And I think these things definitely help to drive value for the company, but it's a lot more impactful, a lot more easier when we come in early on versus later on when, you know, things might be a bit more rigid.
Okay, cool. Yeah, two follow-up questions for the previous part. One is that where do you actually source the company? Is there like a network of VC and angel investor? Everyone just like maybe chat in there, share the information together, or do you actually hire some other external?
Yeah, so there's a few different things that actually happen in the background, right? So One, we speak at a lot of events. We have, you know, a fairly strong brand across the industry. So a lot of founders will, you know, come to us at these events, or we'll share stuff through our website, things like that. So that's sort of the first one. The second one is we also reach out to a lot of founders. We build these sub theses that we talked about earlier. We, you know, have interesting narratives. We want to go find companies in those areas. We'll actually go reach out to founders in different spaces, right? So that's sort of the second one. The third one is we deal flow share with a lot of, you know, really great angels, other VCs, and it's all individual. So it's not like this big group where all the VCs are sort of sharing deals. It's like one-to-one with a lot of different VCs, and it's a very reciprocal thing. It's a lot of time and effort to build up these relationships over time. But, you know, we share deals even before we do them. We ask other VCs, hey, what do you think about this? Have you looked at this? Do you have any insights? I can tell you an interesting one the other day. I mean, we got shared a deal where we actually diligenced, and I'm not going to say the name of the company, but, you know, we actually were very concerned about previous criminal activity of one of the founders. And we actually let this VC know, right? And we were like, hey, this is previous criminal activity from the founder. We actually diligenced this. This is why we pass. But that helps them a lot, right? So that helps to build trust in the future. They're going to want to obviously share more interesting deals with us because we might have some insights on it, right? And vice versa, we're going to share more deals with them so they can give us their insights. And so this is part of the way that sort of VC works as well in the background.
Cool. Interesting. Yeah. Thanks for the enlightening. And then the second follow-up question, then you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of maybe 30-40% companies you see right now are like overly inflated valuation. This is just my hypothesis here, but you know, I mean, I want to hear your take on it. I feel like a lot of the one with inflated valuation probably is really good at attracting hype and riding the narratives or riding the wave, like I said, right? Because in a cycle, there's so many different narratives that people and attention that people can only garner. So I feel like those are might be two things. Like,
I mean, I think there's always two types of companies in that category, right? There's companies that are very good at what they do, and they actually built incredible businesses, have a very strong foundation. They're hyped because everyone wants to get in, right? And those are actually okay, I would say, in a lot of respects. It depends, but it's a lot more okay when there's a very strong foundation underlying a little bit higher evaluation. Now, the bigger problem that I have is when you have these companies that don't have much substance, it's companies that like struggle to raise or have been raising for years and like didn't really build an incredible product, haven't gone and got a ton of users in here that are actually using it and are able to sort of like just sell, right? And so they're selling at these inflated valuations. Maybe they capture a lot of this hype as well, but there's no foundation. There's no underlying substance. And this is where a lot of people get burned. This is where the public gets hurt. This is where VCs get hurt, right? Investors lose money, public loses money, creates a bad reputation for the space. And it actually, you know, I think damages the space long-term even from these types of things. So this is where I'm a lot more concerned.
Yeah, I completely agree with that as well. I think that's one, another guest from episode 18, actually, there was trying to build a streamlining UX for Web3, basically streamlining UX, web gaming UX, Web3 gaming UX, right? He's trying to streamlining it. The company is called Virtual Labs, by the way. They are doing some great job. And he said that Web3 is very much like reputational. So it's meaning, I mean, the reputation with Web3 right now, I feel like for people inside the industry, we know what the reputation we have, but like for the external, right? A lot of it, I think I feel like there's negative attention, negative brand image, right? If you have to keep Web3 as like a brand, usually now brand is associated with like scams, embezzle, losing money, like a lot of the bad things, right? So which is, it's not really good. It's not good for the industry as a whole, because I think that's deterring newcomers, right, and new investors. So it's not a good cycle in my perspective. But hopefully, I mean, we'll be able to, I think we as an industry will be able to overcome it someday. Which brings me to my show signature question, is that what can we do as Web3, you know, innovators and builders to onboard 1 billion people into Web3?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's going to come from a lot of this really incredible companies that have been building over this bear market across all different sorts of segments, right? So where I really think we're going to onboard 100 million or a billion new people into Web3 is generally it's going to come from very incredible consumer apps, right? Super apps, things like this, or even like take entertainment. If you can really break through entertainment or gaming, right? We talked about AAA gaming on here. We talked about what Breshno is doing around even anyone in the world can create a game, and you can create a hyper casual game and share it with your friends. You start creating micro communities, and you know they might even be able to create a billion games, right? I mean, they've created already 170,000 or so games, right? So you think about it that way, and it really unlocks the potential for the entire industry. You know, I don't think it's going to be strictly on trading as an example. Like, we need to go a lot broader, and we need to like really simplify and improve these like UI, UX experiences, these gas fees that are there. Like, you know, all of the complexity in crypto really needs to be stripped away and moved to the background. And that's really the only way we're going to be able to really bring a billion people into this space effectively.
Completely agree. Yeah, I feel like consumer apps would probably be one of the key here to have on board, and UI, UX, good UI, UX also. I think we still have a long way to go. Many of my guests have also said it's probably not going to be this cycle. I also don't think it's going to be this cycle either, but let's see where it is. Anyway, just two more final questions here. One is that since you talk with many founders, I think this might be good for founders here. What sort of advice can you share with founders who are looking to raise funding for their Web3 companies?
Yeah, so if you're looking to raise, I mean, one, I think make sure that you've got a very succinct, pitch, right? I think if you can, one, get your pitch deck down to something like 12 slides, check out the AI tool Pitch League, so pitchleague.ai, and you can actually upload your pitch deck. It'll give you scores, it'll give you some feedback, and it'll already help you think about how do you simplify the narrative on this, right? And I think that's actually very critical, is how do you have like a very clear image. And a vision of where this is going. I think the second thing is, you know, understand your talking points, right? We actually believe that talking points essentially are 11, 30, and 90 seconds, right? And so like being able to really concisely explain what you're doing, where it's going, and how this is impacting the world or the industry is very critical. And oftentimes I find that founders, you know, might take half an hour to even explain what they're doing, and you should be able to do it in 30 seconds, right? So I think that's actually very, very important as well. So once you do get on those calls, to be able to do that. But reach out to us, right? Reach out to other funds, reach out to us. It's, you know, you can reach out to us on our website. You can share what you're working on. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn or any of our team members, partners on LinkedIn or Twitter, and share what you're doing, right? We actually take a look at every single company that shares info with us. So it's not like it goes into this black box. We look at every single one, right? You know, do the same thing with other funds, other angels. You'll pretty quickly, I think, be able to find some support around what you're doing.
Awesome. Yeah, I completely agree with that too. I feel like communication, one aspect, and many people are probably still struggling to. One of the things I learned a lot from YC, I've actually took a YC online startup school. This is a while back. And I think one of the most important lessons that they drill into us is like how to pitch your company, right? And then I think that crafting the message alone is quite a journey. It's not something you can just come up with overnight, but like through pitching, working, talking with other people, building. So it's like an iteration process, right? And then eventually after that, what was it, 8 or 12 weeks, finally came up to this beautiful pitch, right? So it is a journey, just like building your company, right? Building the message and evolving along. So awesome. Yeah, thanks for sharing the tips. And yeah, final question, where can people follow you and your company?
Yeah, so, find us on our website, on LinkedIn, on Twitter. You can just type my name into LinkedIn or Twitter, you'll find me. And definitely reach out, share what you're working on. We'd love to take a look. If you know another founder that's working on something interesting, share it with us or connect us, and would love to, you know, see if we can support your vision and your dreams and, you know, help make it a reality.
Awesome. Yeah. Your website is blockchainff.com, right? I'll make sure to put it in the show notes here. along with any other links at from your side. So anyway, once again, thank you for being on the show today, Ali. It's been a pleasure talking and chatting with you about Web3 and VC.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good one. Bye-bye. And we're back to my studio. What do you guys think about the venture capital world? Feel free to leave a comment below. I'll make sure that both Ali and I will read it and respond to it. If you enjoyed this episode, please give a like and subscribe because it would mean a lot to me. Next episode, we'll be talking to Ruth Zamir. She's the CEO of My Ocean Twin. She's using Web3 technology to solve ocean plastic waste. It's a huge environmental problem, and she's using an innovative solution. So it's an episode you don't want to miss. Thank you for watching, and see you next time.